I next met with Dr. Serge Verstovsek, and to begin, he commented on the important clinical issue of anemia in management of patients with MPN receiving ruxolitinib.
JAK inhibitors inhibit the JAK-STAT pathway. They are not specific for the JAK2 mutation or any other mutation. In myeloproliferative diseases and myelofibrosis in particular, this is the target because every single patient, regardless of genetic background, has a hyperactive JAK-STAT pathway. Now, in normal person, we need to have a JAK-STAT pathway activated occasionally when we need blood. So therefore, when you give a patient JAK inhibitor like ruxolitinib, you would expect to have a degree of anemia and thrombocytopenia because the JAK2 is specifically associated with erythropoietin and thrombopoietin. These are receptors for these growth factors. So in about up to 45% of the patients in COMFORT 1 study, there was a grade 3 or grade 4 anemia associated with ruxolitinib use in up to about 19% of thrombocytopenia grade 3 and 4. This is immediately seen during the first few months of the therapy, and it may result in the dose adjustments. Now, many patients with myelofibrosis are already anemic, transfusion requiring, or about to be transfused, and the issue is, how do you then combine the possible benefits of ruxolitinib in advanced myelofibrosis patients that has a bad spleen and a bad quality of life, which are likely, very likely to respond to ruxolitinib and already present or about to develop anemia in these patients when ruxolitinib is given? Now, what we know from recent publications is that the developing anemia or presence of anemia does not interfere with the benefit of ruxolitinib on the spleen and symptoms. The degree of a symptomatic improvement and spleen response is the same in patients that develop anemia on ruxolitinib versus those that did not. And most importantly, the ruxolitinib overcomes the anemia effect on the survival. In other words, survival benefit with ruxolitinib is equal in patients that develop anemia because of ruxolitinib or do not. That makes sense. It's therapy-related anemia. It's not disease-related anemia. On the other hand, in the control arms of these studies, particularly in COMFORT 1, when there was placebo at the beginning, there was an effect on the anemia that developed because of the disease on its own, on the survival, which substantiate anemia as a bad prognostic factors. But again, there is a difference between therapy-related anemia and the disease-related anemia.
Do you have any sense for how this issue is actually managed in clinical practice, particularly general medical oncology practice, or any things that you see people doing maybe they shouldn't be doing? Do you think people give up on the drug too early?
That's an excellent question. I think this is one of the major problems. I think in what we see right now in a community setting is that people recognize what the drug does. It is not for every single patient with myelofibrosis. It's not really even related to a risk of dying. It is for patients that suffer from symptomatic splenomegaly or general systemic symptoms from myelofibrosis, because these are the two aspects of the clinical problems that the ruxolitinib can actually significantly improve in great majority of the patients. If anemia is present, it may, and it does in some cases, interfere with the desirable benefits. What people do is they're afraid from that anemia that can be caused and may start with the ruxolitinib at too low a dose. Now, what we need to understand is, first, what I explained, that the anemia is not detrimental by any means. But if you do start with a lower dose, it is important to increase the dose of ruxolitinib in monthly increments. Let's say you start with 10 milligrams twice a day instead of 20 twice a day like you would otherwise by guidelines. And if you need to go up, you should go up in monthly increments from 10 twice a day to 15 twice a day to 20 twice a day to optimize the overall benefits and not worry too much about the anemia in first 3 to 6 months where all the benefits are to be seen. This has clinical connotations on overall outcome of the patients because the disease best response, and I'm talking about the spleen response, responds the best to the higher dose of ruxolitinib. The higher the dose of ruxolitinib, the better the spleen response and the survival. The survival of the patients is the best if they have a smaller spleen.
Is there sort of a tachyphylaxis to the anemia? You know, if you transfuse the patient, do eventually somehow they require less transfusions with time, or is it just persistent?
This is really good because the anemia being so prevalent and bothering people, and you can worsen it, right? And you have patients that are already so anemic, transfusion requiring. How do you treat that patients for the spleen and symptoms when you may worsen transfusion requirement? What we know is, based on a detailed analysis of patients from COMFORT 1 and COMFORT 2 phase 3 studies, that yes, the anemia develops, up to 45% of patients may have it, but there is a rebound in a red blood cell count over time. Over first 3 to 4 months, there is a significant rebound in red blood cell count, even in patients without the dose adjustments. I cannot really, and we were not able really to understand why that happens, but it does happen, and it reminds me of an experience with imatinib. Obviously, imatinib in different setting with chronic myeloid leukemia, where there is at the beginning some anemia, and then there is a rebound as the bone marrow reconstitutes from decreased malignant clone. We certainly do not talk about the same effect on the bone marrow with the ruxolitinib in myelofibrosis, but that's the best explanation I can have. There is a significant rebound in red blood cell count. Therefore, in everyday practice, I am not worried that much. I am worried to some extent, but not crazy worried about some anemia that may happen at the beginning. I like to maintain the dose at a higher level. I count on the rebound, and I do adjust if necessary, but I let the patients benefit from the high dose of ruxolitinib to decrease the spleen as much as I can for them to live longer.
So let's talk about some of the clinical scenarios you brought in here today, beginning with the patient with intermediate 1 risk myelofibrosis.
Case number 1 is 68-year-old, which presents with the intermediate 1 risk myelofibrosis based on age. No symptoms, no spleen, relatively good counts, clinically irrelevant things that need to be treated. However, we have a genetic testing done, so this was done in academic centers, sometimes even in community settings, and you get some other mutations than the JAK2 mutation, and EZH2 was identified as a bad one. Would you then do something more about that patient than telling the patients, look, you have a low-risk disease by convention, but you have bad genetics, you are at the risk of rapid progression, maybe you need to do the transplant right now rather than waiting? That's the gray area. We don't have the answer, and it does depend a lot on the doctor involved, on the actual success of a transplant, right, which you would push patients for, because there are still some significant risks associated with early mortality with the transplant. And so the real prognostication and then therapeutic decision-making based on the genetics is not ready for prime time. It has to be individualized. And really, one needs to consider all the aspects of the particular case before telling that patient, like this one, hey, you have this EZH2, do the transplant now or else. I would not do it, for example.
Again, in this lady with the EZH2 mutation, what did you recommend?
I would recommend a continuous observation, perhaps not every 6 months, but every 3 months, to see at what pace this patient will progress. And if we see the progression, then is the time to do the transplant. Let's say that the anemia develops or spleen starts to grow, then you intervene, but not when the patient is asymptomatic and only has that genetic background.
Let's go to the second situation, the 76-year-old man with long-standing MF.
Patient is benefiting from ruxolitinib for a long period of time. There are issues with the low red blood cell count and low platelets, but patient is stable. And the issue is the loss of response. No medication really works forever. How do the patients lose the response to ruxolitinib? Either they have a progressive splenomegaly, they have a slow development of anemia or thrombocytopenia after being stable for 2 or 3 years, or the symptoms come back, or sometimes the blasts go up. All of these are possibilities. There is no one pattern, and one leads to another. But the point here is that the loss of response takes time. It's not overnight, and one can see it. And you can optimize the therapy and not say, oh, you are losing response, let's stop the therapy and find something else. There is not much else. Our experience is that the survival of the patients after ruxolitinib is only 14 months. We presented this at the meetings, and it's short. So you optimize the therapy in this particular case, perhaps by adding hydroxyurea. If the blasts go up, you add hypomethylation agents. It's anemia problem, add danazol or erythropoietin. Optimize your care, combine, and make sure that patients is on the therapy as long as there is any benefit.
It's interesting because I remember doing an interview with your colleague, Jorge Cortez, and he presented the exact same scenario. And what I noticed, and we have the same thing here, spleen originally 12 centimeters goes down to 2, but then when the response is lost, it's still 7, so it's less than what it was in the beginning. Is that kind of an important point for you?
Yes, yeah, so the loss is happening, but it's not lost. There is still better than a baseline. You don't judge your response to the best response. You judge your response to the baseline. and the patient is in a process of losing response, so you need to do something about it. Maybe send the patient now to transplant, okay? Or maybe you can add hydroxyurea. You need to do something about it because eventually patient will lose response, and then that will be a very bad situation.
So what about this other scenario, the 59-year-old man with anemia and an occasional transfusion requirement?
The question is about identifying patients for therapy with JAK inhibitors and the starting dose. Now, this patient obviously suffers from everything that can happen in patients' life with MF. Severe symptoms, enlarged organs, and anemia. And so the numbers otherwise are pretty good. Platelet number is 170, which allows you to use ruxolitinib because it is more than 50,000. That will do well for, likely, very likely, the systemic symptoms and the spleen and the liver. But you may push patients to require transfusions. And by the book, the starting dose for platelets of 170 would be 15 milligrams twice a day. Now, that can actually lower the red blood cell count, and inexperienced doctors might say anemia is detrimental for the patients. I don't want to even use ruxolitinib, or if anemia worsens, I want to stop the therapy. One in everyday practice needs to understand that anemia is not detrimental. It will happen. The red blood cell count can rebound within 3 to 6 months. And those adjustments are fine to do. It's not all or nothing. And if one is really worried about anemia, lower dose, I have seen this in clinic quite often, lower dose of ruxolitinib are tried first, 10 milligrams twice a day, for example, instead of 15 twice a day. But then that dose needs to be improved in monthly increments to a highest dose possible to decrease the spleen as much.
So you had a couple of PV case scenarios also, beginning with your 62-year-old man.
This 62-year-old man now is over 60, so by the conventional risk assessment, he would be moving with his ET to a high-risk ET patient requiring cytoreductive therapy to decrease his platelet numbers. His white cell count is slightly elevated. His hematocrit and hemoglobin are within normal limits. However, for experienced eye, perhaps additional factors that you see on a routine CBC listing would lead you to suspect that the patient actually has a PV. This is a masked PV. If the MCV is 76 and normal is 82 to 94, and patient has very low ferritin, you would say, I need to test for erythropoietin level. And I bet erythropoietin level will be below normal. And with any iron that might be given to patients, which I would not advise, because iron deficiency is a result of uncontrolled growth of red blood cells, these patients actually would fulfill, at this point in time, diagnostic criteria for PV. That's why the threshold for red blood cell count was lowered. And this hematocrit of 47, coupled with the iron deficiency, and you can do even bone marrow biopsy to see hypercellularity, you would change diagnosis of these patients to PV. And that treat patients with cytoreductive therapy for control of the platelets, white cells, and red blood cells, all three together.
How about your 76-year-old patient with PV and itching?
Once you try patients on cytoreductive therapy, you traditionally would only look at the control of hematocrit. And I think everybody, I hope everybody knows that it has to be maintained below 45%, and it should eliminate the need for phlebotomy. Now, this patient presents like that with a good control of hematocrit, but look at other characteristics. You have high white cells, you have high platelets, you have a spleen, you have symptoms. We are talking about the people, and person needs to have all aspects of the disease controlled. So traditionally, the look on a blood cell count and a red blood cell count in particular is not good enough anymore. Even in the clinical studies or for approval of a new drug, what we are trying to emphasize is control of red blood cells, white cells, platelets, spleen, and symptoms. And this patient has uncontrolled disease in my eyes, right? It's not only about hematocrit. You need to control the quality of life. Decrease those white cells, platelets, and spleen. So this is uncontrolled disease requiring either increase the dose of hydroxyurea. If the hydroxyurea cannot be increased because of side effects, alternative therapeutic option needs to be given.
Such as?
Such as ruxolitinib is the JAK inhibitor approved for patients with uncontrolled disease when they are on hydroxyurea. Interferon is useful in very young people because of side effects. 76-year-old, if he has uncontrolled disease with hydroxyurea, ruxolitinib is the next.
So let's finish out with your 27-year-old patient with ET and a platelet count of 1.7 million.
This is not an unusual presentation for age or the number. It is known that Filadelfia chromosome negative MPNs are more common as we age, but in ET there is a bump on incidence in the 20s and 30s in females in particular. We don't know why, but these are young and healthy people, right? And remember, the platelet number is not the risk factor for thrombosis, all right? So this patient is young and healthy, nothing wrong. This is a low risk for thrombosis, okay? We are overemphasizing this platelet number and risk of thrombosis. But this patient likely has a 1 Willebrand factor deficiency, which comes with so many platelets, they ingest the 1 Willebrand factor internally, and you have acquired the risk of bleeding. So you can test for it. And if that's the case, you would not give this patient aspirin. That's by the guidelines. You would actually consider, and I quote, consider cytoreductive therapy to decrease the platelets because of risk of bleeding. I mean, I had a patient like that yesterday, you wouldn't believe it, where there was a question what to do. Would you then risk bleeding, or in these patients, even then the patient is not an aspirin, or you would treat for risk of bleeding and decrease the platelets to less than a million, where this 1 Willebrand factor deficiency is usually gone and you can get the patients back on aspirin. But the issue is cytoreductive therapy. What do you do? 27-year-old, hydroxyurea, take hydroxyurea forever. That means another 60 years of hydroxyurea. Hydroxyurea is a chemotherapy, increased risk of skin cancer, always questionable increased risk of transformation to acute myeloid leukemia. You cannot dispel that in a 27-year-old who reads all the literature. And then interferon. Interferon is my choice. I would treat these patients for risk of bleeding with interferon, but knowing also that interferon is a biological agent that usually cannot be given forever. In the study so far, median duration of pegylated interferon alpha 2A has been about 5 to 7 years, median duration of ability to deliver to young people. So it's a mixed bag. There is no correct answer, but I would go for safety. If I need to decrease risk of bleeding, interferon.
What did you do with the patient yesterday?
I suggested interferon. I have a patient like this who said, I don't want any therapy. I want to just live at this level, 2 million platelets. I am aware of risk of bleeding, no aspirin. I'll be careful. And you cannot argue about this. It's a patient decision after all.
Can you provide an overview of the disease features of each of the myeloproliferative neoplasms?
We are still talking about the three characteristic classic Filadelfia chromosome negative myeloproliferative neoplasms. And these are basics on the PV, ET, and myelofibrosis. Just to get a sense what we are talking about, what is the problem with each disease, what cells are affected primarily, and why they are called what they are called. Like ET is called because platelets are high. Myelofibrosis is called like that because the fibers in the bone marrow that prevent cells from growing, and the clinical scenario is different. The anemia, thrombocytopenia, develops big spleen as a reaction to the failing bone marrow and constitutional symptoms and a short life expectancy. So the spectrum of clinical problems is different, but they are tied very well clinically and biologically together. The transition that we can see in some patients from the most benign condition, ET, some patients, up to 10% of the patients, actually can, over time, acquire high red blood cell count and become polycythemic. This is funny. In the clinic, patients come with a long-term history, 5 years history of ET, and now the hematocrit is high. Nobody suspects any change, but in fact, they have evolved into PV. They don't have two diseases. Patients think, I have ET, now I have PV. No, it's one condition. We know also that everybody with ET and PV is at some risk, low risk of progression to myelofibrosis, and that all three conditions at a low rate can progress to acute myeloid leukemia. So we are talking really about biological continuum that is not evident in everybody, but it's possibility in a smaller proportion of the patients. Underlying problem is the abnormalities in the JAK-STAT signaling, and JAK-STAT signaling is very well characterized intercellular signaling pathway, so a cascade of proteins inside the cells that do different things to different cells, depends where they are. And there are those enzymes that are associated, the JAK family members, there are four of them, that are associated with receptors for different cytokines or growth factors from inside the cells. And when cytokine or growth factor attaches to receptors, that would activate the JAK, and the JAK would activate the STAT, and the cells would do different things. But in the bone marrow, that leads to a production of red blood cells and platelets in particular, and some degree of increase in white cells as well. What is important is that specifically in the bone marrow, the JAK2, one of these four family members, is associated with the receptors for erythropoietin and thrombopoietin. So we depend on the JAK2 as an enzyme for making red blood cells and platelets. Now, in the disease state, we start to unravel the biology of the problem by identifying the JAK2V617F mutation in MPN in ETPV and myelofibrosis that leads to a lack of a need for a cytokine or growth factor to bind to receptor. The mutation makes this JAK-STAT pathway always active and results in overgrowth of the cells. Now, you would say, obviously, that might have been a cause for MPN, but it's not. I mean, obviously, why would one patient with JAK2 mutation develop ET and the other PV and the third one myelofibrosis when the same mutation is present in their cells? And now we know it's much more complicated. This is not the cause for the disease. It's one of the drivers of the disease existence and progression. And it's not present in everybody. That was actually the main issue at the beginning. It is not the cause. It's not present in everybody.
Could I just ask you, in terms of JAK-STAT signaling, I feel like I've heard something about that in some of the meetings we've done on checkpoint inhibitors and immune therapy. Is there a connection between these pathways?
It is a possibility because with more experience with ruxolitinib, for example, we know that ruxolitinib affects the immune system in a recipient, in a patient. There is effect on NK cells and T cells, and the immune system is altered to some degree with ruxolitinib in myelofibrosis patients, and there is a possibility that immunocheckpoint inhibitors may have actually activity in myelofibrosis by unleashing the immune system to recognize malignant cells like it does in other conditions. There are studies, I'm aware of several studies with immunocheckpoint inhibitors in myelofibrosis to potentially work on that pathway of the combination between the two and possibly benefit the patients. We'll see. These are studies underway.
So what about JAK inhibitors?
So JAK inhibitors would inhibit the JAK-STAT pathway regardless of this mutation. And what they do is they bind to ATP binding site on the enzyme. ATP is the energy source. So energy needs to bind, obviously, to enzyme for enzyme to do something. Like with imatinib in BCR-ABL and chronic myeloid leukemia, where imatinib binds to ATP binding site on the BCR-ABL protein, the JAK inhibitors bind to ATP binding site of the JAK2, regardless of whether this is mutated or unmutated protein. So they would inhibit the growth of the cells, lower the platelets and red blood cells, and the spleen, and improve the symptoms because of anti-inflammatory and anti-proliferative effect that the JAK-STAT pathway is responsible for. But you will also have a degree of anemia and thrombocytopenia, and this is the balance in the clinic that we need to know about. And we need to know that it is about controlling of signs and symptoms. It's not about elimination. You do not really expect the elimination of the disease. And over time, since 2005, when JAK2 mutation was identified for JAK-STAT pathway activation, we know that there are others. And we call them driver mutations. Again, they are not the cause per se, but they are major participants in activation of the JAK-STAT pathway. PV, majority have a JAK2V617F mutation, but there are others. JAK2 exon 12 in 3%. Now, ET and PV are more related in this driver mutation analysis. MPL, which is MPL mutation, that's a receptor for thrombopoietin, for a platelet-making growth factor. So MPL is a receptor on the surface that is mutated in some and obviously would activate the JAK-STAT pathway. Calreticulin, or CALR, and there are two types, is a novel finding. This is a protein that is chaperone in endothelial reticulum, a part of the cell which we did not know how to connect when this mutation was identified to activation of JAK-STAT pathway, but it binds to MPL receptor. So we are discovering this at the fast pace, how the biology functions in MPN. But the basic question is, why would the JAK-STAT pathway activation lead to different clinical scenarios? And it seems that this is because of the presence of many, many other mutations that can be identified in patients with ETPV or myelofibrosis, a spectrum of about 10 or 12 different mutations. These mutations are identifiable much more often in more aggressive conditions, from ET and PV, rarely, in myelofibrosis and AML, often. So other factors lead to different clinical scenarios, and these mutations can be participating in many other parts of the cell function, not only acting on the JAK-STAT pathway. So particularly of importance here is epigenetic component of these mutations. SXL1, EZH2, IDH mutations are part of epigenetic control in the cells. Now we have even targeted therapies in the clinic for these agents. Some of the myelofibrosis patients might benefit from these targeted therapies. But the biology is moving beyond the JAK-STAT pathway hyperactivation to understanding other parts of the abnormalities in the cell function.
This epigenetic issue, is that the reason for looking at hypomethylating agents with, say, for example, JAK inhibitors?
Yes, and there are studies, first with the hypomethylation agents azacitidine and decitabine, and more recently, many studies with the histone deacetylase inhibitors. There are some activities with these agents even on their own. The combination studies are underway, and many have been done combining the JAK inhibitors and epigenetic regulators. You are correct. Now, this is interesting stuff. You see, we are able to test to a great extent for many different mutations, many different patients. But what happens when you do this in normal people that are supposed to not have any disease, you can actually find these mutations in normal people without the disease, and you can then call this age-related clonal hematopoiesis. So because the presence of a mutation would identify clonality and malignancy potentially, we don't call it malignancy, just clonal hematopoiesis without clinical relevance. This may affect the understanding of the biology of disease. Not all mutations may matter. On the other hand, the order of acquisition of these mutations may matter for the clinical outcome. You know, we are calling about clonal expansion and clonal evolution and clonal competition. These are cells that grow. I always use the example of my hair. It used to be blonde and then brown and then black and gray, and it's all my hair, but it's changing over time, right, with different characteristics. The same happens in the bone marrow, right? New characteristics, new clones with new characteristics can overtake and lead the clinical outcome of the patients in a different way. No better example is than the development of acute myeloid leukemia. It is known that in many patients that have a JAK2 positive, that means JAK2 V617F positive myelofibrosis or ET or PV, when they develop acute myeloid leukemia, they lose the mutation. They lose the mutation. So how can this be? Well, because there are many clones in these patients. It's not all uniform, and most of the time, responsibility for developing acute myeloid leukemia is mutation or mutations that happen in non-JAK2 mutated cells. So do you have a clonal overtaking of the disease? The blasts go up, different genetic profile develops, and the cells that have a JAK2 mutation die off. So the number of mutations that we are able to identify, it's exponentially growing. In MD Anderson, we used to have 28 gene panel. Now it's going to 49 gene panel. Some are using 400 gene panel. You can really dissect the genetics in people. And I emphasize this possibility of even having those mutations in normal people. So we need to be careful not to overemphasize the presence of certain mutations in patients and really know what they mean if we are able to. We don't have a real name for this state of, we don't like to use polyclonality, multiple different clones. Oligoclonal state perhaps is the closest, because these are malignant cells after all with different genetic profiles. So therefore, we are now certain that JAK2 mutation is not the cause of the disease. It is about JAK-STAT hyperactivation with contribution of other mutations that we are unraveling and trying to target as goals of therapy as well.
What's your vision about the pathophysiology of why you see splenomegaly with myelofibrosis and why JAK inhibitors like ruxolitinib help?
This is a question that was asked immediately after first three patients on a study when we saw 2 out of 3 had a great degree of a spleen reduction within a few months. Even my boss, who is skeptical by nature, came to my office when I told him what's happening, and he knew the patient from the beginning and couldn't believe it, that the 20-centimeter spleen that you can feel within 2 months go down to zero. And how can this be? Which cell is responsible for that spleen, and which cell is responsible for such a rapid reduction? Because our idea was that the spleen is reactive. There is extramedullary hematopoiesis, which is fancy name for a bone marrow outside the bone. There was some blood making in that spleen. And as you know, you take the spleen out, you find the bone marrow there. We call it ineffective erythropoiesis. We don't think it makes much blood in majority of the people. And suddenly you give the drug and the spleen goes down so fast and there is no tumor cell kill, there is no tumor lysis, there is no effect on the blood cell count related to the degree of a spleen reduction. It's independent activity on the spleen. And what cell is responsible? What are we doing? We don't really know. The one way would be to take samples from the spleen as it's shrinking, but nobody obviously can do that. And so we are still in the dark on a real effect on the spleen on its own. We just say it's anti-inflammatory and anti-proliferative effect of the JAK inhibitors that is combined together to do that because of inhibition of JAK-STAT pathway, which is important for inflammation and proliferation. But beyond that, I don't really have the answer. It's very strange.
Interesting. I like this idea of the three W's. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Once you have a genetic testing done, usually you ask yourself, why am I doing that before you do it? But these days, the genetic testing is being done so often in many clinical scenarios, and you need to know what do you do with this information. So why? Obviously, you have several ways of application of the genetic information that you get from your testing. And one that is certainly embedded in everyday management of patients is for diagnostic purposes. Now, there are hundreds of papers written on prognostication with the genetic mutation added on to standard prognostication, but I caution everybody that this is not ready for prime time. And certainly for monitoring of the disease progression of response to therapy, we are far away from that. The JAK inhibitors do not alter the number of cells much with the mutations in patients' bodies as they ingest the pills. We do not really have a major therapy that would require monitoring of a genetic component on the therapy like imatinib in CML, where we aim for a complete molecular response. Now, when do you do that, then, is a question. You would usually do that at the diagnosis for diagnostic purposes, but during disease course, we have little evidence that that is actually useful, and it's very costly. I have patients come through my office and say, why don't I have this genetic testing done, a 28-gene panel, once a year with the bone marrow to see how do I progress? Well, who is going to really pay for that, and what's the therapeutic benefit of such an intervention? I do not agree. You test when there is a progression, and you try to explain it. So this is why we would actually test for, and this is really what is part of a standard practice these days. These driver mutations are part of the genetic code that is necessary to be looked at when you have a suspicion of any of the Philadelphia chromosome negative MPN. Obviously, you first test for BCR-ABL to make sure it's not CML. And then you go to this particular algorithm, unless you do all at once, which is possible in some academic centers, but you would go with the most common mutations in different disease to identify malignant clone. And it is now, since April of 2016, actually built into the diagnostic criteria for any of these diseases, ETPV or myelofibrosis, to test for JAK2 mutation, calreticulin or MIPL, or for JAK2 exon 12 in case of PV. And this is, for example, seen very well in the case of polycythemia vera, where among the major criteria, we have the addition of the JAK2 V617F or JAK2 exon 12 mutations to be tested for if possible. But see, what we are looking for is also simplification of the diagnostic criteria in PV, and we are also looking for more therapeutic relevant diagnostic criteria because we realized over several last years that there is no good understanding of what polycythemia vera is. In polycythemia vera diagnostic criteria, there are two major changes. These are very important for everyday practice. Number one under the major criteria is elevation in hemoglobin or hematocrit. Now, the numbers that are provided have changed. They are significantly lower. The hemoglobin level decreased from 18.5 to 16.5 for men and from 17 to 16 for female. Why? Because many times with this, we see patients with elevated platelets, borderline or high normal red blood cell count, and we don't think that patient might have a PV. We don't pay attention to iron deficiency that can be present, low ferritin, or low MCV that develops due to iron deficiency. In other words, many patients with ET develop iron deficiency because they actually have a PV. They do not present with high red blood cell count. That has been recognized and called masked PV. And now the major criteria have been modified to decrease the threshold for a diagnosis of PV because of this particular factor. And the bone marrow was brought up to the major criteria as mandatory test in majority of the patients. I don't do it in everybody. When it's obvious PV, I don't really do it, but it's important information for prognosis. If there is karyotypic abnormality or there is some fibrosis already, these people would progress faster. For ET, the diagnostic criteria have changed a little. We have to have a high platelets. Bone marrow is mandatory. We would really like to have patients have a bone marrow biopsy done to make sure this is ET because of another development, and this is the introduction of a prefibrotic myelofibrosis. Prefibrotic myelofibrosis has been inserted between the ET and overt myelofibrosis. What we typically think when we talk about myelofibrosis, you have a grade 2 or grade 3 on a scale from 0 to 3 myelofibrosis, you have a big spleen, anemia, left shift, high LDH, that's the overt myelofibrosis. Yes, I agree. What we realize is there are patients in between ET and myelofibrosis. These are prefibrotic patients, no myelofibrosis there, but they have all the other findings that are possible, slightly elevated LDH, slightly elevated white cells. They may have some abnormalities in white cell differential. And the most important factor to distinguish between ET and prefibrotic myelofibrosis is actually the appearance of the bone marrow, megakaryocytes, and the structure of the bone marrow. So actually, a lot depends on the eye of the hematopathologist. And that's the major concern, that is there an experienced eye that would tell a patient with high platelets based on a bone marrow whether there is a ET there or prefibrotic myelofibrosis. And this is being questioned, and it's evolving field, but it has been introduced in WHO classification of MPN in April 2016. Again, prefibrotic myelofibrosis is a disease entity on its own. Traditionally, we would look at the prognostic factors for thrombosis in ET patients because they have a normal life expectancy, or majority would have. We are concerned about the thrombosis in these people, not about survival. And traditionally, you would use age over 60 or history of thrombosis as the two factors that would lead you to say, yes, this is an ET patient with high risk for thrombosis. Again, age over 60 or history of thrombosis. And then you would treat not just with baby aspirin, you would treat with hydroxyurea or interferon or other one of the medications for platelet control. Of note, a platelet number is not the risk factor for thrombosis. That is something that is not understood very well. It is age and a history of blood clot. But now we have IPSET. This is accounting also for cardiovascular risk factors and genetics. So this is the first time ever, actually, in MPN, Philadelphia chromosome MPN, that for clinical practice, we are asking people to test for JAK2V617F mutation and combine it with three other factors. So you have four factors that would lead you to decide patients in low, intermediate, high risk, and then treat them or not treat them with aspirin or cytoreductive therapy. This is going to come up very soon in NCCN guidelines as well. It's already applied in everyday practice across the Europe. It's coming to the United States, so it's very important to pay attention to new developments of assessing thrombotic risk in ET. In polycythemia vera, when we come to thrombotic risk assessment, we are still bound to two factors. Still age over 60 or history of thrombosis in the past. But there are other indications for use of cytoreductive therapy beyond those two factors, and we need to understand that it is not only about the control of the blood cell count, the progressive symptomatology requires cytoreductive therapy. If these symptoms are not controlled well or the progressive leukocytosis settles in, these are additional factors that at this time and age we need to worry about. When it comes to platelet numbers, we worry about the bleeding when the platelets are about 1.5 million because of acquired von Willebrand factor deficiency, similar like in ET. At that point in time, you stop the aspirin, you cytoreduce for risk of bleeding, and then a patient is safer. Standard practice in a community setting for polycythemia vera is once you introduce an idea of cytoreduction to apply hydroxyurea. Majority of the doctors in the United States do that, and we aim to control several aspects of the disease at this point in time, not only one. We are beyond just controlling hematocrit below 45%. That has been shown in prospective randomized study to actually decrease the risk of clotting and decreases the death rate of the patient. So hematocrit below 45% without the use of phlebotomy is the goal of hydroxyurea or cytoreductive therapy in PV. But not everybody benefits. The factors that experts in the field identified as factors identifying patients that are not doing well on hydroxyurea. And in fact, further analysis of patients that fulfill this criteria of resistance or intolerance says that these people actually have a more aggressive disease. They have a high risk of progression to myelofibrosis and a high risk of transformation to AML. So we are not only identifying with these factors patients that need other cytoreductive therapy, these people actually have worse prognosis. After hydroxyurea, one may apply interferon in polycythemia vera or very rarely in elderly, busulfan, alkylating agents, which is known to cause increased risk of acute myeloid leukemia, so it's very rarely used. Now, ruxolitinib as a JAK inhibitor, because of hyperactive JAK-STAT pathway in PV, as it is in ET or myelofibrosis, was developed in a second-line setting for polycythemia vera. For patients that have inadequate response or are intolerant to hydroxyurea, we have a summary of the benefits. It's basically controlling what we would like to control. Not just the hematocrit, but also white cells, platelet symptoms, and the spleen. And for practical purposes, it is also important to know that 10 milligrams twice a day, 10 milligrams twice a day is a starting dose for all PV patients. It's not like in myelofibrosis where you start based on platelet number. It's one dose, and then you would expect about 66% of the patients, or two-thirds, to increase the dose during the first few months, and only about 10% to need less. Myelofibrosis will come to a patient in a different form and shape. We know that about 80% of the patients will have progressive organ megaly, spleen, and liver, maybe enlarged liver. In about 40% of patients, almost everybody over time have progressive cytopenias, and about a third will become transfusion dependent. And this is coupled with the progressive constitutional symptoms, night sweating, low-grade fevers, itching, loss of weight, and cachexia, leading to decreased quality of life and performance status. This is slow death for me. I saw that patients when I started in MPN 12 years ago, there was nothing to do. Now we can do things for these patients, but we still have an issue of myelofibrosis-related complications and progression to acute myeloid leukemia, all leading to premature death. We need to realize that acute myeloid leukemia only happens in about 20 to 25% of patients. So as a one item, it's a leading cause of death. But 70 to 75% of patients die from myelofibrosis-related complications. So it is myelofibrosis that we need to control better. The question is there still a need for splenectomy in myelofibrosis?
What's the answer? Have you had sent any patients for a splenectomy in the last year?
Yes, but not often. There are still indications, but the associated risks are serious risks.
How about splenic irradiation?
Last resort. After assessing patients for a splenectomy, then you go to radiation. Now, acute myeloid leukemia can develop in up to 20-25% of myelofibrosis patients, occasionally directly from ET or PV, but it is a terrible condition for the patients. Median survival is somewhere about 5 to 7 months, not years, months. And really, there is not much you can do. You can watch the patient, you can give them intensive chemotherapy, and really nothing works unless with intensive chemotherapy you get them to CR, which is possible in about only a third of the patients, not 70%. Only about a third of the patients will go to CR after intensive chemotherapy, and only those that go directly to transplant have a chance of a long life. Otherwise, they relapse right away. And indeed, there is no much difference between phase one study, observation, or intensive chemotherapy without the transplant in terms of their survival. So you do not engage anymore. And this is something for clinical practice, very important. In induction chemotherapy, unless there is immediate transplant possibility, what we learn over the last 5 years is that hypomethylation agents, like azacitidine, on their own have activity in accelerated or blastic phase MPN. That means 10 to 20 or 20 plus percent of blasts after MPN. This is accelerated blastic phase MPN. Hypomethylation agents have activity. They can be given in outpatient setting, and a life can be longer, not 5 to 7 months. It can be a year and a half to 2 years. And we treat people not for CR, it is possible, but for a control of the disease for as long as possible with hypomethylation agents, as it's coming up in NCCN guidelines, for example, that were published in October online here in the United States. For accelerated blastic phase, hypomethylation agents with or without JAK inhibitors for spleen and symptoms. With the combination, you can actually do a good job in improving quality of life and preventing further progression of the disease. That would be standard practice. The field is moving over to perhaps prevention. Prevention of the progression is a very hot topic these days. Early information comes from utilization of the interferon. Dr. Silver in New York is a grandfather of our efforts to utilize interferon in Philadelphia chromosome negative myeloproliferative neoplasms, and an example of his experience in early stage myelofibrosis where there appears to be, without control, which is a problem, without control, appears to be an improvement in bone marrow features and perhaps clinical outcome of these patients, but that requires the prospective randomized studies. And one of those studies is underway in Europe, but not with interferon. This is with the JAK inhibitor ruxolitinib. This is a very interesting study, trying to prevent progression. So first ever official prospective randomized blinded study for early stage myelofibrosis where there is no need to treat, with perhaps bad genetics that have a chance of progression faster than others. and prospective study for 3 to 5 years to see whether ruxolitinib can actually prevent progression, not just treat the patients that are in need, but prevent them from getting there to be that bad.
What about antifibrotic agents?
Excellent question. This is where I think that antifibrotics have the major role. There are several antifibrotics. We were hoping that simtuzumab, which is a LOXL2 antibody, was one to deliver that antifibrotic benefit. The paper on the outcome of phase 2 prospective randomized study was published several months ago, and it was unfortunately a negative study. The next antifibrotic that we are excited about is PRM151, which is given IV monthly. It can even be combined with the ruxolitinib. This study, large phase 2 study, accrued all the patients last year, and we are expecting the results by the end of this year. Hopefully, with the degree of a decrease in a fibrosis in the bone marrow, you would have improvement in the blood cell count. This is where the study is being done, in patients in need of improvement of anemia or thrombocytopenia. But I think your question is excellent. Would the antifibrotics, in fact, play the major role in prevention of progression? And I would say yes. This is where I would like these medications to be given. Patients that have ET or PV with fibrosis that are at the risk of progressing to overt myelofibrosis and shorter life expectancy, or early stage myelofibrosis patients, these are the types of patients that I would treat with antifibrotics. But these studies require time and effort and money. So I'm not sure that we're going to see them soon, but yes, I agree with you. This is the area for antifibrotics.
One other new agent I wanted to ask you about is imetelstat.
So imetelstat is telomerase inhibitor. It was studied in a pilot study by Mayo Clinic in Rochester and published in New England Journal of Medicine as active agent for myelofibrosis and essential thrombocythemia. Of particular interest was a paper in myelofibrosis, which is a deadly disease. People die on average after 5 to 7 years. And the notion that this agent can induce complete response and partial response in about 20-25% of the patient was big news. That's why the paper was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, the leading medical journal. The CR means elimination of the disease. A partial response means everything normal, but still some evidence of the disease in the bone marrow. That does not happen with any other agent. I mean, there are anecdotal cases of such event with some other agents, but 20-25% response rate for CR and PR is unheard of. So that agent was taken up by larger pharma to study in a much larger study, multi-center international study, about 200 patients, studying a higher dose and a lower dose, because the higher dose that was used in pilot study was a little bit also too toxic. There were some issues with liver toxicity. The drug was on clinical hold by FDA for about 10 months, and too much of myelosuppression. Many patients have very low blood cell count for a very long period of time. So there were 100 each arm study, which in fall of last year was analyzed, a first look, what we say, after about 20 patients on each arm. And unfortunately, and to my surprise, the news was that the further enrollments was halted because of a lack of a serious or a good enough, I would say, response. The patients on the lower dose were discontinued from the therapy. They were able to cross over to higher dose, and the higher dose arm was allowed to continue with therapy on already enrolled patients, but no more enrollment. And recently, there was a further analysis of the same study telling us this agent is active and we will continue to treat patients that are already enrolled, but no more enrollment until further notice. And so this is where we are right now. Half of the study was discontinued completely. The higher dose were allowed to continue with the therapy, but no further enrollment, and we'll see what the news will be by the end of the year.
What's your best guess?
Well, it's never a good sign when the company that sponsored the study says no further enrollment. The good news would be we want to double up the enrollment, not to cease the enrollment and see whether these patients that are already enrolled will have a good enough response for further drug development. Unfortunately, it is active drug. We know that from that New England Journal of Medicine paper. It has to be something with perhaps patient selection or some other factors that needs to be analyzed from current experience that will tell us what the future of this drug is.
And it's a telomerase inhibitor. Is it kind of like chemotherapy or targeted therapy? What's your vision of it?
Well, that's a good question, because the claim is that inhibits telomerase. Telomerase is an enzyme at the ends of chromosomes that maintains the DNA that is usually lost piece by piece when the cells divide. So if you inhibit the enzyme, there is a major loss of DNA and these cells will die. Now, in the New England Journal of Medicine paper, there was a supplement there that actually looked at the specific inhibition of the telomerase, and that was not the case. So there was no connection between the inhibition of telomerase and the clinical benefit of that drug in that pilot study, which was pointed out in editorial on that medication, that paper in that journal. So I'm not sure what actually this drug does and how it does. Whatever it does, it was good, and we were hopeful that the drug would pursue that winning mentality from the pilot study. So at the moment, my enthusiasm is diminished because of issues with the apparent lack of a proper efficacy in the larger study.
Did you yourself have patients who were treated with this agent who you thought benefited?
I was participating in a study in essential thrombocythemia. And yes, there was a benefit, as it was reported in the New England Journal of Medicine paper on ET. Everybody had a control of the platelets to some extent for a duration of the time. So there is activity to that drug.